of course, the theme of the night in Vancouver. And for the Hamilton Tiger Cats, Zach is back. Been so solid tonight. And this one goes right. Now look who's back is Brandon Banks. And he's thinking
there
about
he
it. He
there
will
he
take
goes.
It. Speed kills. Forget it. See you later. Brandon Banks is going to score here and change this game completely. Oh my goodness, what a run. And he will go to his reliable target, Luke Tasker, for the touchdown, and now the Cats are going to make this interesting. It's over the top this time. Touchdown, Terrence Tolliver.
That was sick.
Don't go away, Matt Dunnigan.
That was sick right there. The timing of that throw, I mean, that was beautiful. That resembled Zach Collaros from last year.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham.
So, Mike, remember a few weeks ago when you lied to our listeners about picking the Eskimos against the Ticats, and you actually picked the Ticats, and then we decided that we were going to punish you, and we had a punishment that was going to be you singing a song, and I believe that was supposed to be last week, but then you didn't do that, and then everyone kind of rejoiced. I got a lot of comments about everyone saying they don't want to hear either of us try to sing, and then we put it out there to get other punishments.
Yes, I do recall.
We got one. This one came from friend of the show, Joe Pritchard, USFL Tecmo, on Twitter. Everyone out there who listens to the show is probably already following him. He's got his own podcast out there, the Rouge, White, and Blue podcast. Big, huge CFL fan, lives in the States, awesome dude. He came up with one that I really like. So I got to ask you a question, though, before we can kind of get into this. The Saskatchewan Roughriders are going to be heading to Edmonton in a couple of weeks. Are you going to be attending that game?
I am off, so I believe we will be there.
Okay, so this was all Joe's punishment was all predicated on you going to this game. So what he says is at the Riders S game, which will be on Friday, August 26th, you, my friend, have to bring a sign. And that sign, it will either say part of Chris Jones's pre-practice squad or I have more class than Chris Jones. It's your choice, but you have to bring one of those two signs. I think this is a fun, funny, and appropriate punishment. I can't see you having any problems with doing this. Am I correct here?
No, that's very doable.
Okay, there is one addendum I would like for this, because chances are you're not going to get on TV holding the sign, although maybe you will, and that'd be awesome, it'd be hilarious. But here's my addendum to this. You have to take a picture with yourself, either at the game or before the game as you're getting ready to go, and broadcast it on social media. I think that's only fair, because then that proves that you made the sign.
Yeah.
I think that's fair, and then just yourself holding the sign, I think that's good.
Yeah, that works. You know, if there's no photo evidence, then who's the hell to say that I actually did it? So, yeah, that's fair.
Okay, awesome, awesome. I thought that'd be a great little addition to it. And hell, maybe because of all this stuff with Jones and how he's going back to Edmonton, maybe you will get on TV and we'll all get a great laugh out of it if you hold up that sign.
That would be pretty cool.
Okay, so before we get into the actual football stuff, we got to do some little house cleaning here with our fantasy team and the CFL podcast Family Fantasy League. We did not get the result we were looking for in week 8. We lost to the CFL Horsemen 178-142. Drops our record to 5-3, but we are now in a 3-way tie for second place. We are one game back of first place, so we're still in the hunt. We still got a chance to take home this title. That's all that matters to me. We're showing that we're one of the best fantasy squads in the podcast world, CFL podcast world it is. So our next game is this week. We play the 2-and-out podcast. They beat us back in week 2 by a score of 181-147. So we kind of owe them one, I would say. Now, they got lucky that week. They took advantage of the Ticats' terrible play against the BC Lions. But maybe we can reverse that trend this week because the Hamilton Tiger Cats play a very bad Saskatchewan Rough Riders team. So hopefully our Ticats players, Chad Owens, Luke Tasker, Simone Lawrence, they can gobble us up some points and get us back our win, and we can jump up to 6-3. I think that would be very, very helpful. So the schedule makers have shined down on us, and now it's just up to the team to go out there and make some hay for us in this league.
Yeah, we're sitting pretty good. I mean, still have 2 weeks before the mid-season point, so still lots of times. And Yeah, I think we'll put a beating on the 2.5 podcast this week.
I'm hoping. So let's get into the game that we watched last week. Thrilling comeback by the Ticats that fell just short. They lose in BC to the Lions, 45-38. Normally, we've broken this down this year into an offensive review and a defensive review, but we have to start off with the man of the hour, Zach Caleros. He went 24-40 for 331 yards, 2 touchdowns, and an interception. A couple of nice scrambles in there as well. Mike, what did you think about Caleros' first game back in 11 months?
I thought it was pretty good. The first half was a little bit shaky, but I don't really blame that on him because, I mean, the first play of the game, he gets walloped from the defensive end or they sent a blitz or something, but the offensive line didn't protect him that first play. He got nailed, and, you know, I was pretty worried because, you know, it wasn't a knee shot or anything like that, but for his first play to get hit like that was kind of concerning, and he fumbles the ball. BC gets the ball back, and, yeah, overall, I thought it was a really good performance. I'd probably give him, like, a B-plus if I was grading him. It wasn't his best, but you can't expect that after 11 months off, so I thought it was really good. And especially in that second half, he really turned it on. And, you know, the offensive line started playing a little bit better, protecting him. So, yeah, I was happy with his performance. And I think it's just going to get better, you know, next week after he has a game behind him.
I really don't need to say much of anything. You said everything I possibly could have said. I the slow start was expected, but there were those flashes of brilliance he showed. The big throw and run by Chad Owens, where he scrambled out, found Owens. Owens makes a cut, takes it upfield for like 50-something yards.
The touchdown was beautiful.
Yeah, like there you saw little things in the first half, and then the second half, it seemed like they really got going, and he started to resemble that player that looked like the best player in the world last summer. So, again, I don't think we could have expected him to come out and go 32 for 40, 400 yards, 4 touchdowns. Like, that would have been unreasonable, and I think we lowered our expectations, and I think we were honest in our assessment of where we thought he would be during this game last week when we talked about it. And I think he went out there and performed about as well as I could have hoped. The completion percentage, I hope, goes up. 60% is not great, but again, first game back in 11 months, I'm a tough team. Like, we cannot discredit how good BC actually is. And I think people forget that. Like, this is a 5-2 football team that is going to play this week against the Calgary Stampeders for a battle for first place in the West. Like, this is a really good BC team. Their defense is excellent. So for Caleros to look this good, and especially as the ball kept rolling, and as the game kept going on, he looked better and better and better. I think a B-plus, your grade there, perfect assessment of how he played.
You know, he scrambled quite a bit. His knee looked fine. I remember he was running outside, you know, getting away from defenders one play, and he kind of, you know, stopped on a dime, and I was kind of worried that his knee might blow out or something, but it didn't. It seems to be all good in that respect. So, and the one play that really impressed me was a screen pass to CJ Gable. He showed a lot of patience. You know, he sat back there to the very last second and got rid of the ball, and then CJ Gable marched down the field for a huge kick. So that's one of the plays that really caught my eye and made me happy that Zach was back.
Yeah, this game wasn't just about Zach, though. He was the story of the game for obvious reasons. But this team, again, got down huge. They were down, 32-12 at halftime, allowing 30 points again in the first half. But then they kind of shut BC down. They only allowed 13 points in the second half, and that to me is good. If you allow 13 points in a half, you're going to win a lot more games than you lose. But I think a lot of this offensively, the slow start in the first half goes towards that offensive line. They were just bad in the first half of the game, especially that left side of Brian Simmons and Peter Dyakowski. I thought that they did not look great. And 5 sacks allowed is unacceptable in a full game, let alone in just one half. The line did pick it up in the second half and allowed Caleros to not get hit at all, so that was good. But I'm starting to think, and I think we're starting to see, that it might be time to accelerate that transition from Dyakowski to Brandon Revenberg, the rookie. I know it's tough to throw a rookie in there and have him start, but Dyakowski looks like he's been in this league, 10 years now? That's a long time for an offensive lineman. I think maybe Dyakowski should be transitioning into that six-man role that Tim O'Neill played here so well for so long. And I think we're seeing more and more, and we should see more and more, of the rookie get into the lineup. What do you think? Do you think it's time to maybe, not necessarily make a full wholesale change right now, but sort of accelerate that transition from the veteran to the young guy?
Yeah, it's been a tough year for Dykowski, and even last year he wasn't at the top of his game, I think. And you know, he's a fan favorite. He's a funny guy, great guy. He's been a really good tie cat for many years. But you might be right. Maybe it's time to start to pass the torch to the younger guy. Maybe do a little bit of rotation in there. And you know, he's getting beat too much. Last year he had a lot of procedure penalties, and he's not the same player since that injury back in 2013, I think, in the Grey Cup game. So yeah, I think you might be right, and his career might be maybe not coming to an end, but he might be, you know, switching roles into that sixth man, like you said.
Yeah, and that's not anything against Dykowski. Like, he's played at a high level for a decade in the CFL, and guys get older, and they drafted Revenberg, and Revenberg's not going to take over for Bombin. Bombin's going to be, he's a younger guy, so he's going to be here for a while, and I think maybe this offensive line might look a little better if we had Revenberg in there, and then when Jake Olsen comes back to replace Brian Simmons, I think that line could look a lot better. Receiver-wise, though, Terrence Tolliver looks like he's starting to find his groove again. Missed a few games earlier in the year and was replaced by Tyquan Underwood. Got to think that if Tolliver was in the game where Underwood dropped the touchdown pass, that they probably would have beat Winnipeg, but that's neither here nor there. He's starting to really look like the player that he looked like last year, and I think the one underrated aspect of Caleros' game that we kind of forgot about was how much he likes to throw the deep ball. There was a lot of instances where he was throwing deep, and I think with Tolliver, he's more of a deep threat, and I think we're going to see more of him over the rest of the season. I think he's going to start piling up some yardage. I think he had 120 yards against Winnipeg back in the game before Claris came back, and I believe he put up 80-something yards, 90-something yards in this game. I can't remember. But yeah, I thought he had a pretty decent game, and I think out of all the receivers, he's kind of the guy that I think we can expect to see more of going forward. He had the nice touchdown catch, too. Like, that was a beautiful throw and catch by Claris Tolliver on that TD.
Absolutely. He had three catches for 58 yards and a touchdown.
That's it. It seemed like he had more than that.
But yeah, I totally agree with his – I think his potential is through the roof. He's got the height, catches pretty much everything that's thrown its way. He's a good route runner. Like on that touchdown pass, he was just beat his defender. Claros threw that pass. He was perfect timing, easy touchdown. So yeah, to add him to the receiving corps is a huge deal, because it's just, you know, we have Owens, Tasker, and Fantuz, but to have him in there, you know, doing a great job, really adds to the offense as well. So I'm a huge fan of Tolliver.
Yeah, and Claro spread the ball around. Owens led the team in receiving yards. He had 95 yards. Tasker led in catches with 8. Found the end zone for the first time this season, which was nice. Andy Fantuz was kind of the odd man out. He had only 4 catches for 24 yards, none of which came in the first half. And again, I think this goes back to what Claros likes to do with the ball. He likes to throw deep, and he does it better than anyone else in the league. Derek Taylor from TSN did his details segment on Claros' deep balls from last year, and if you go and watch that on the TSN website, you'll see how good Zach Claros was throwing deep. So I think maybe Fantuz is going to be the guy that sort of, we see he had a great start to the season, but I think the game plan is different. With Mazzoli, it was a lot of short throws, quick throws, and Claros likes to go deep. I can't emphasize that enough. So I think we're going to see a little bit more of Tolliver, like I said. I think Owens and Tasker are still going to be the guys. Like, Tasker's obviously his go-to guy. And I think Fantuz might slow down a little bit, but I still think that he's going to find his groove eventually as well. I just think that with so many weapons on this offense to go to, there's going to be someone each week that doesn't get the attention they deserve. But I think so far, at least in this first game, it was pretty good ball distribution. All right, Michael, I think that's enough about the offense. Let's roll into some defensive talk. That was your area of expertise this week. What did you see from the defense this week that you'd like to discuss?
Well, all around, especially in the first half, well, only in the first half. In the second half, they played really well. They stopped Jennings from, you know, walking all over them like they did in the first half. It was pretty bad. So, you know, the secondary was atrocious in the first two quarters. They couldn't cover anyone, it seemed. Jennings was having just an amazing game. They weren't getting much pressure on the quarterback with the front four. So overall, just a bad performance in the first half. But then in the second half, they just seemed completely different. They came out and they seemed to be throwing more blitzes at Jennings, and you know, they were getting to him. And he just seemed like a totally different quarterback in the second half, because he didn't have enough time and he wasn't making his throws. So, tale of two halves, really. First half, terrible. Second half, pretty darn good.
Yeah, I think at one point before that final drive or before Jennings got it going a little bit in the second half again, near the end there, he started to piece together some good stuff. And yeah, of course, he had the game-winning touchdown drive. I think at some point he was like 2 for 7 and was just like they had completely figured him out. And then he got it rolling and led to the game-winning TD near the end of the game. I just can't figure this out, why this team, and we talked about it a bit with the offense, we talk about it every week for what seems like a month and a half now, how did they go from being absolutely atrocious in the first half to nearly unstoppable in the second half? And the defense, again, it's like, what you're doing in the second half is clearly working. Why would that not have been part of the game plan in the first half? Like, it seems like it's so simplistic. And maybe we're just idiots and we don't know what we're talking about, but it seems like when they get pressure, every unit from there on looks better, because the secondary is a weak spot in this team. I think we can both agree on that. So to help them out, they need to get after the quarterback. When they get after the quarterback, the secondary looks good. Emmanuel Davis had the big interception. Then he trips on what me and my brother like to call Eric Decker grass. I don't know if you know Eric Decker. He's a wide receiver now for the New York Jets. But he was with the Denver Broncos a couple years ago. Wide open. Catches a pass at midfield and just inexplicably trips. And gets. It would have been a touchdown. Like, it would have been like an 80-yard touchdown catch. So ever since then, every time we see a guy fall on the turf, we call it, oh, he must have hit that Eric Decker grass. He hits the Eric Decker grass. The Ticats do score a couple plays later, so it didn't really hurt the team any. But that's their second interception of the year. And like we said, the secondary has not been great. They've been a work in progress. But when the defensive line and the linebackers can get some pressure, that secondary looks a hell of a lot better. And Emmanuel Davis, for example, can make decisions like that, can try things like that to make the big interception. It happens. It helped turn that game around in Hamilton's favor until the very end. I just don't understand how this team can be so Jekyll and Hyde.
It's a big question mark. And for example, I think it was the first play of the game from scrimmage for the BC Lions, and they rushed 3, and Jennings had like 10 steamboats back there, and he just, you know, had all day to look for his receiver, throw it up deep, and it was a touchdown. So, you know, sometimes the rushing 3, dropping 9 into coverage works, but I'm not necessarily a huge fan of it, and I don't think they should be doing it that much. I think they have more success when they're bringing the house. Not, you know, I don't want them to blitz every play, but it seems to work out for them when they rush, you know, 5 or 6.
Yeah, even 4. We've seen this year with Saskatchewan, for example. They are always only seem to be bringing 3 men, and their defense is getting torched. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that continues this week against the Ticats, and Zach Kolaros can sit back there and pick apart that defense. But I don't understand these teams. I know sometimes you want to, like, BC has a great receiving corps, so you want to get extra men in coverage. But is putting Adrian Tracy or John Chick in a zone coverage really that big of a difference? Like, they're not cover guys, and yeah, it works sometimes against some teams and against some quarterbacks, but it doesn't work all the time. And I don't know, maybe the defensive scheme is just too complicated, and there is a lot of new faces here, and maybe that's part of it as well. This is the first year where we've seen a lot of change on the defensive side of the ball. Brian Hall's gone, Justin Hickman's gone, Eric Norwood's gone, Craig Butler's out, we lost Eric Harris, like Brandon Stewart. Like, there's a lot of guys who were starters or key contributors to this defense that are now playing elsewhere. Maybe that has something to do with it, but I'm positing this point, and yet I'm thinking to myself, that would make sense if the defense was bad or inconsistent throughout the entire year. But it seems in the same game they go from can't make a play to can only make plays.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just frustrating to watch this defense get walked over in first halves of games, because, you know, we saw it in the Winnipeg game where they were up by a million, and then this game where they were up by a bunch too. So the team just can't afford to go down by that many points. And yes, they've come back. You know, they came back in this one, didn't win it, but they came back in the Edmonton game, won it. But it's just too much work. It's too hard to come back against these good teams in the CFL this year. I mean, pretty much everyone has a chance in every game, you know, minus maybe Saskatchewan. But you just can't go down by that many points in the first half and expect to come back every week. So they have to really, you know, make some adjustments in the first half to give this offense a chance, give this team a chance to, you know, be close when the second half starts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Special teams, though. Once again, the special teams unit, 2/3 of it were awesome. Brett Maher continues to make us forget who Justin Medlock was. Perfect again on the night. He now has made, I think it's 12 straight field goals, 13 straight field goals. Hasn't missed since that horrible game in Hamilton on Canada Day. Of course, there's also Mr. Brandon Banks. I remember I cut up audio for our weekly theme. I obviously put the Speedy B return in there because it was one of the coolest plays we've ever seen. You actually, when Richie Leone misses the kick, you hear Matt Dunnigan go, uh-oh.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
almost like he knew what was going to happen, and then you just see Banks make one move, and it's like, he's gone. And yeah. no one came close to him. Just these two guys, week in, week out, are making plays for this team, and I couldn't be happier with 66% of our special teams. We'll get into the coverage units in a second, because they have not been good this year for some odd reason. Again, maybe player personnel, but what about these two guys? You got to love them, right?
Yeah, Leone, the kicker for BC, was just amazing all game. You know, punting the ball, field goals, all that. I swore that he, you know, it was only 30-something yard field goal. I thought that, okay, he's going to make this for sure. And he went, you know, wide left to right. I forget which way it was. But I was pretty shocked he missed it. And then it's a pretty safe bet that Banks is going to take it back if you miss a field goal. I mean, you got the slower guys out there in coverage, and it's easy for him, it seems. And, you know, he continues to impress me year after year, week after week. He's just one of the best returners I've ever seen. And Brett Maher, you know, you can't say enough about the guy. He's making those long field goals. He's making, like, every field goal, like you said, 12 in a row or whatever it is. It's great to see, because – and his punting's great too. So to have a punter kicker that can do both jobs really well is a huge benefit in the CFL, because we know that special teams are more important up north than they are down south in the NFL.
It just kind of dawned on me. I was thinking about this as you were talking, when you were mentioning where Leone missed the kick. Do you think returners, and this is something I'm going to throw out there, maybe we can look back on it, and maybe we can look at it in the future. He was kicking from the far side and missed it wide, like the other way. Do you think maybe that leads into more return men going, okay, all the cover guys are on the other side of the field. I have this entire wide side, and I'm the fastest guy in the field. Like, do you think that maybe plays into his decision and other returners' decisions to take it out of the end zone on a missed field goal? Even when that's so short, like 32 yards is not a long field goal. So the even the linemen and all those guys are still pretty close, but because it was so far off to the one side, that's got to play a role, right?
It's got to be a factor. I mean, the big guys that are blocking up front, they have to run to the other side of the field, and you know, they're not gonna catch up to Banks, especially if they have some blockers in front of them making some good blocks. So yeah, I think that's probably a big factor, and it was obviously a good decision on his part.
So there's one thing else I'd like to talk about overarching in this game, and it was the last play of the game. What did you think of the call on 3rd and 5 to go deep to the end zone? If you go back and watch, you see that C.G. Gable is wide open underneath, could have picked up the first down, extended the game, but Zach Caleros made the decision to go deep, go for the throat, try to tie the game. There were 4 BC defenders down there, only 2 tie catch receivers, didn't come anywhere close to being complete. Do you think the call was the correct call? Do you think maybe the execution was the problem? Or did you like the call? Did you think, yeah, you know what, go for it now? Or would you have like I personally would have preferred him to try something short to keep the game alive? What do you think?
Well, I don't know if that was his, you know, if that play call, that was his first option to go deep. But if it wasn't his first option, it was Clara's decision. I don't like his decision on that play. I think that you have enough time left. There was 30 some seconds maybe left on the clock. I think you know, dump that ball off to CJ Gable. He gets the first down and you keep playing. You know, get closer to the end zone. Don't make that kind of Hail Mary pass. If the guy's open, then yeah, sure. But like you said, there was four BC defenders down there. Not, you know, the ball landed and there wasn't a Ticat really close to the ball. Tasker might have been the closest guy, and he was probably 10 yards away. So yeah, I don't like that decision. I wish he would have just went for the first down and kept playing, because, you know, there was a good shot that we could have scored that touchdown if we get that first down there. So no, I don't like the long ball decision from Claros or whoever called that play.
Also, you get the ball in CG Gable's hands, you don't know if he's going to make a guy miss and score himself.
Yeah, exactly. He could get, even if he doesn't score, he could gain, you know, 15 more yards, and then you're that much closer.
Yeah. I figured you'd be on board with me on this. I did not like the call. It just felt like, why end the game there when you didn't have to, is pretty yeah. much what I see. There was still plenty of time left on the clock. They were really close. They were probably within, what, 35 yards, 40 yards of the end zone? Yeah, so for it to end there was kind of, it's kind of, especially for a game that was so exciting near the end, it was kind of a deflating way for the game to end.
Yeah, it was a little disappointing. You know, I was hoping that they'd make the comeback and, you know, push it into overtime and see what we can do there. But yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that decision, but we move on and hopefully grab a win next week.
Hopefully. So, Chad Owens Jersey Watch continues. This guy, week in, week out, even when he doesn't put up massive numbers, has just been so productive and steady that I've almost resigned myself already. Like, I feel like I should just go down and pick the damn thing up now so I can wear it while he's on the team this year. But yeah. Against BC, he had 4 catches for 95 yards. I wondered if he would still have some chemistry with Zach Caleros because they haven't played together since 2013. But he's still looking for Owens. He had the big 51-yard catch. Like, he's still a part of the game plan. So his totals for the season, 35 catches, 471 yards, still only the 2 touchdowns. So his touchdown numbers have come down. But he's on pace for 90 catches for over 1,200 yards and 5 TDs. We've probably said this before, when he signed, I did not expect him to be this productive, but he has become, again, one of the better receivers in this league, and it's kind of amazing. He's putting up receiving numbers that he put up in the year that he won MOP, and he's not even being talked about in the MOP conversation, and probably won't be, but he's putting up those similar numbers, and that's pretty impressive for a guy who won MOP 4 years ago.
Yeah, but you got to consider the, you know, he was doing a lot of kick returning and punt returning back then too, so that probably factored into his MOP that year. But yeah, it's good to see that Caleros has that chemistry with him still, and he just seems to make all the tough, like every tough catch he's made this year. You know, we could go over all the great catches, but there's been a bunch of them. So yeah, like Jeff Reinbold said when we interviewed him, he's going to contribute a lot to this team. He's going to be a leader, and that's what's going on right now. So, you know, I couldn't be happier with his production. Great signing in the offseason by the Ticats.
For sure. Not much in the way of Ticat news this week, but I was wondering, did you get a chance to check out that TSN special on Zach Caleros?
Yes.
How awesome was that?
It was really, really interesting. A great original piece by TSN. You know, that followed him from the start when it happened and right to his, right till when he was healthy. So it was a great piece by TSN.
Yeah, it was a cool little 7-minute mini documentary. If you haven't seen it, I highly suggest you check it out. It was really well done and shows you the type of work that this guy has put in to come back from that devastating injury. It was a very well done piece by TSN. And when TSN puts their mind to it, they could do some really cool stuff like this.
Oh yeah, they've done some great stuff in the past for the CFL, and you know, I hope to see more in the future because they can really, you know, it's just they do a really good job when they put their minds to it.
Yeah, maybe we'll see one on SJ Green next year.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Hopefully. I hope he comes back healthy like Zach did, and he can be the same SJ Green because he's been a really fun player to watch, and I hope to see him in the future.
So CFL news, we got a couple player release, a couple Canadian defensive linemen were let go over the last couple of days. The Montreal Alouettes released Vaughn Martin, and the Toronto Argonauts released Brian Bulkey. 2 Canadian D linemen won't stay on the open market for long. What do you think about these releases, and where do you think that they might be headed? What teams do you think might be kicking some tires on these two gentlemen?
Well, I'm kind of surprised at the Bulkey release because he just got healthy and seemed like he was ready to suit up for the Argos and maybe help out in a rotation. But I'm not sure where Bulkey might end up. Maybe I'm thinking that they released Bulkey to take a shot at Vaughn Martin, but I've also heard that the Ticats are kind of interested in Vaughn Martin. I'm not sure who tweeted that, but I saw it yesterday. So, you know, it depends where they end up, but I'm hoping maybe, but you know, on the other hand, I'm not sure because Vaughn Martin hasn't produced that well. So I was going to say, I'm hoping that he ends up with the Ticats, but if he doesn't have the spark anymore, we were just talking about it off when we weren't recording. Maybe he's, you know, been in the NFL for 5-6 years, comes back and he just doesn't have the spark anymore to play in the CFL. But, you know, if he's that top level guy that he used to be, he'd probably be a good pickup for Hamilton. But if he's not, then, it'd be a waste of time. I'm sure there's plenty of teams out there looking for Canadian talent on the defensive line. So I'm sure they'll both end up somewhere.
Well, there's one team out there that is looking for Canadian talent, period, because they were fined a week or 2 weeks ago for not having enough Canadians on the field, and that was the Saskatchewan Roughriders. I got to think that both these guys are being looked at by Saskatchewan very heavily. I would not be shocked if one of these guys signs with the Riders. That's where I think they're going to go. And any team, these are defensive, Canadian defensive linemen. who have the ability to start. Yeah, Martin hasn't looked great, and Balky's been dealing with injuries, but I think these are two guys that, if they get in the right situation, can contribute and can be a good rotational player or a spot starter if needed. So I definitely think that these guys, unless they don't want to play, will find somewhere to play ball again this year. And I think Saskatchewan is looking at both these guys and will probably be pitting them against each other in a numbers game to see who will sign with them. I would be shocked if one of these guys didn't end up in Saskatchewan, or at least that Saskatchewan wasn't looking at to bring these guys in. Maybe they decide to go elsewhere, but I think Saskatchewan's got to be in on signing one or both of these guys.
You've had a tough time on the defensive line this year, so that would not be surprising if one of those guys show up in Saskatchewan. Maybe not the best decision for them right now, because the Riders seem to be a pretty bad team this year, but you know, if the money's there, then I'm sure at least one of them will jump at the opportunity.
So speaking of Saskatchewan, I don't even know where to start with all the craziness that has gone on in Riderville since we last sat down to record. So I guess it all began with a tongue-in-cheek tweet by Bo Levi Mitchell, where he says that after the Riders signed a bunch of guys, he says something to the effect of, oh, I bet none of them had to book plane trips to get to Regina. This led to some digging by the CFL. They said they've been looking into this for a while. It all comes out that apparently the Riders had some pre-practice squad of 20 or so players that they were housing in Regina and paying them. These are all rumors and so forth, but this seems to be the accepted story as of right now, is that they had potentially, including their active roster, their six game injured list, their one game injured list, up to 95 players in Regina. Like, that's two full teams, for crying out loud. And they were housing a bunch of these guys and paying them off the books, which is a circumvention of the salary cap. So all this nutty stuff is going on, and then the league decides that the Riders had been doing something illegal, and they fined them $60,000 and then deduct $26,000 from their salary cap for this season. I gotta ask you, do you think this punishment for what they did was harsh enough?
I would like to see maybe take away a draft pick, but on the financial sides, I think it's the biggest fine in CFL history. So I'm not complaining about the fine. I think that was a good number, but I would like to see them maybe take away a draft pick just to, you know, cement that home that you can't be doing this. And I've heard people say that, you know, every team does it, but I don't think it's to that extent. So I just wish they would have took away a draft pick, but the money side of things, I'm okay with.
You know, I've heard this every team does it stuff, and I recognize that teams stash players on the one game injured list so they don't have to put them on the practice squad, so that they don't get poached or they don't have to release them. Like, the teams do that, but this is something entirely different. This is like saying everyone speeds and they go 110 on the highway and you're the guy going 160. And you get caught, so you're pissed off, and your excuse is, well, everyone does it. Well, no, not everyone does this. This is something different. The draft pick would have been totally cool with them losing a draft pick. From what I understand, that wasn't allowable under the CBA and under the rules. They weren't allowed to dock them a draft pick. But one thing they could have done is they could have put out some suspensions. And personally, I think Chris Jones, as the vice president of football operations, the general manager, the head coach, should have been suspended for at least one game. If we look to the NFL, and I know it's a different league and a different commissioner and different rules, we saw when the New Orleans Saints were dealing with their Bounty Gate scandal, we saw their head coach get suspended for a season, and we saw their general manager get suspended for eight games. I can't see, this is obviously not as bad as giving players incentives to injure other players and other teams, but this is one of the worst cheating scandals, I think, in the CFL that we've seen in some time. And I think that a suspension for Chris Jones would have been warranted. One or two games, I think, would have been completely fair.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but yeah, that's a good point. If you're not allowed to take away the draft pick, then a game suspension for the head coach would make sense, because he's running the show, right? He knows how many players are at practice. He knows what's going on, so he should be the one that gets the punishment, along with the team and the fine and all that.
Yeah, the fine absolutely stays. I think the fine is fine. To not sound redundant, but when Sean Payton was suspended, the Saints head coach suspended, he said, I didn't know what was going on. And the reason he was suspended was the commissioner of the NFL came out and said, you're the head coach, you need to know what's going on. Same thing here. Chris Jones can play dumb if he wants, but he's the head coach and the general manager. He is well aware of what was going on here. So for him to kind of get off light here, I think, is I don't know. I didn't want these guys to be like I heard of vacated wins and postseason bans, and like that's ridiculous. This isn't college football. That is dumb. That was never going to happen. That's just stupid. And like, what, you're going to vacate one win? Whoop-de-doo. But no, definitely a suspension, I think, for Jones. A game, maybe two, was absolutely warranted.
Yeah, for sure. All that talk about, you know, not allowing them in the postseason or whatever, I agree, that's ridiculous. But
well, they're doing a good job of not getting in the postseason themselves. They don't need any help.
Yeah, no kidding. But yeah, you know, a game suspension would have been good for Chris Jones. He's been really pushing the envelope this year, it seems. He's in a tough situation, and he's doing whatever he can to try to turn that situation around, and it's just not working out for him.
No, and I think this would be a lot different if they were winning. I think people who are against the Riders would be a lot more angry about this if they were, say, 6-1 instead of 1-6. Because then people would look at it and go, well, are they winning because of all this cheating they're doing? But I think because they're 1-6, I think people are like, man, you're doing all this and you're still getting your butts kicked? Like, what the hell?
They're bad at cheating. We were listening to the radio before the Edmonton game we went to last week, and they were kind of poking fun at them, you know, saying that they're cheating, but they're terrible at it because they're 1-5 at the time. So it was kind of fun.
Okay, so it's Bozo of the Week time, and it kind of plays into this. This wasn't the only this started with all this fine stuff, and then it just delved into like tinfoil hat territory. Your Bozo of the Week, Mike, is
gotta be Roddy Peterson from the play-by-play guy for the Riders. We've talked about him before. He's an interesting character, but his defense of the Rough Riders and attacking other reporters, mainly Three Down Nation's Justin Dunk, has to make him the Bozo of the Week. He's just such a blatant homer. I mean, I can understand there's homers, you know, in radio that call the games, in local markets, the radio guys, you know, there's some homerism in every city, I think. But he's just way, 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 way over the top. And to attack other reporters that it turns out were right, because the CFL fined the Rough Riders, so they must have been doing something wrong, is silly. And you know, he just proves that, you know, I don't want to be too mean, but he's just a bit of a tool. You know, he's just, you see over and over again, we see things from him that just make him such a bozo that he's my Bozo of the Week.
He is claiming there's a conspiracy against the Saskatchewan Rough Riders.
Uh-huh.
Like, something must have happened in the game. I'm assuming it was the pass interference call that wasn't pass interference that the Riders challenged and lost. And I hate to break it to the Rider fans out there who think that Peterson's right, but that was not pass interference. He did not touch it. Like, it was, I watch it going like, I hope this isn't PI, because this should not be PI. And then after the game, he doubled down on this conspiracy claim when the Riders were fined $5,000 for taking over the midfield logo during player introductions when they were in Calgary in week 7. And then he was like, this is further proof of there being a conspiracy against the Riders. And look, Rod Peterson may be a nice guy. I imagine, honestly, he probably is. If you met him, he's probably a great dude.
Mm-hmm.
But his public persona, the one that he gives off to everybody, he comes off as like just a rabid homer without a shred of objectivity. And with this conspiracy stuff, he comes off as a tinfoil hat wearing lunatic with a persecution complex. Like, I don't know where he's preaching to his fans, his choir here, and they're the ones who are definitely, like, they would believe this stuff. And there are people out there who do believe it. I will say this, though. Most Rider fans that I have interacted with think this is a complete joke, that he's out of his goddamn mind and there's no conspiracy against the Riders. Why would the league office have a conspiracy that is anti-Rough Rider? Especially because, as those really homerific Rider fans like to say, they're the money-making engine of this league, and the reason the league exists is because of them. Wouldn't the league then bend over backwards to make sure that they weren't persecuted? Like, it defies logic. If both things are true, there's a conspiracy against the Riders, or the league office hates the Riders, but the Riders are the reason the league is still operating, those things just, they can't mesh. They can't exist at the same time.
Doesn't make sense. I recall I saw a retweet of a Madani tweet saying, like, why is the CFL fining their cash cow and all this? And, like, well, what do you want them to do? They broke the rules. Like, are they supposed to play favorites just because the Riders have a lot of fan support? Like, it's just ridiculous. And, you know, they did what they did so they can, you know, they can eat it. So Rod just comes off, like you said, I'm sure he's a nice guy and everything. You met him in person, but he comes off as a complete homer and a bit of a jackass in his public persona. So I don't know what the real deal is with him. I don't know what he is as a, you know, what he's like as a real person, but the person that he puts out there in the public is not very likable.
No, and Justin Dunk does not need you or I or anyone else to defend him. His work stands on its own merits. He's a colleague of mine at Three Down Nation. We've had him on the show. I'm a fan of his. I've been a fan of his for a very long time since he was working with the Ticats a half dozen years ago. Like, I like Justin Dunk. I think he does a great job.
Yeah, and he's not like, you know, he works for Sportsnet, but he's not negative about the league all the time. He just does his reporting. He's just reporting on the league. He does his investigating. He's not like a constant negative guy like Arash Madani. He has good sources. He's a good reporter, and he does a good job covering the CFL.
And he's a fan of this league. He's a former 5-year starter at the University of Guelph. Like, this guy has Canadian football credibility. And look, like I said, Rod Peterson, probably a great dude, but when he comes out in public and he accuses guys like Justin Dunk and guys like Scott Mitchell, who is also considered amongst the CFL reporters to be one of the most stand-up guys there is, of making cavalier accusations, like, Rod, like, just stop. Like, you're just digging a hole. And maybe this is to build an us versus the world mentality in Saskatchewan. Maybe that's what they need. But I just think this is the wrong way to go. And let's be honest, in a credibility battle between Rod Peterson and Justin Dunk and Scott Mitchell, I'm on the Dunk Mitchell team 100%.
Yeah, that's a no-brainer there. I mean, you know, we could go through the stories that Peterson has put out there that haven't come true, but we won't bother. So, yeah, I totally agree. The credibility goes to Dunk and Mitchell.
Yeah, well, and the other thing, if you read Drew Edwards' piece on Three Down Nation earlier in the week that defended Dunk, he brought up an interesting point in that Peterson said that there were some things that he had heard or he had seen that counteracted what Duncan, or it was when Craig Reynolds came out and said we weren't paying guys or leaving him here, and Peterson was like, yeah, that's the stuff that I had heard. And then Drew was like, well, if you'd heard that and didn't report on it, aren't you in dereliction? Like, you know what I mean? Like, he knew something was going on and kept it to himself. And if that's what he's doing, then he's not a very good, and I know he's not a reporter, but, and I know he's a play-by-play guy, and you brought up that most play-by-play guys are homers, and that's fine. His play-by-play and all that stuff, that's fine. But I consider myself a pretty big homer, but I'm not above criticizing the team that I cheer for if they're doing something that I don't think is right. And I've done that numerous times. And I've been told by people within the Ticats organization that they appreciate me as a writer, as a contributor to the CFL discussions, because I'm not afraid to challenge the team when I think they're not doing something right. They like that I root for the team, and that they always see me as fair. And I've been told that by many people that work within the organization. Peterson's not fair. He's just simply homer. Like, it's simply nothing bad can ever happen to the Rough Riders, and if anything bad happens, it's apparently a conspiracy. And to me, that just destroys any credibility he may have had.
Yeah, he seems to always have his green and white glasses on, doesn't he? So, yeah, he's definitely the Bozo of the Week this week. And, you know, maybe he'll be a Bozo of the Week later in the season as well.
Yeah, it certainly seems with this that he has he's shooting up the rankings for Bozo of the Year at the end of the season.
Ooh, yeah.
This is going to be tough to top. Conspiracy talk, that's going to be tough to beat. Okay, so as much as I'd like to get away from talking about the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, we can't, because this week, we're going to get into our game preview now, it is the Saskatchewan Rough Riders coming to Hamilton to play the Ticats. 5 weeks, 4 straight away games, and the Ticats are finally back at home. I finally get to sit in a stadium and watch a live football game. Since the beginning of July, you've seen more live Ticat games than I have, and you've only seen one.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cats will play 3 of their next 5 at home and only leave the province of Ontario twice for the rest of the season. Wow. August 28th against Calgary, September 24th against Saskatchewan. Every other game will be played in Hamilton, Toronto, or Ottawa. I think that's big. I think that gives this team, especially because a lot of these games are division games, where the Ticats, I believe, are 2-0 in the division still, because all those road games, with the exception of Montreal, were against the West. So winning in the division is the big, it's those 2-point, like those those four-point games because you get the points and the team you're playing doesn't. So I think the schedule is going to work out for the Ticats at the end of the season here. But that's going forward. This game specifically against Saskatchewan on Saturday. Mike, what are your keys to the game for the offense for the Ticats to finally get the win, get to end this two-game losing streak, and to finally win at home for the first time this season?
Well, the main thing for me is the offensive line. Just protect Claros better. He got nailed too many times in that game last week against BC, especially in the first half. They really improved in the second half, but it's all about protecting Claros, you know, giving him time back there. If you give him time, he's going to tear apart any defense in this league. So I think it could be a really big bounce back game for the offensive line, because we know that Saskatchewan has had trouble getting pressure with the front four. So it's all about the offensive line protecting Claros. And if that happens, I think everything else will fall into place for the Ticats. I think it'll be an easy win, and the offense will put up big numbers if that happens.
I think that's right. I think it all starts. It's a cliche, but it's a cliche that's true. It's apt. It starts in the trenches. You win football games in the trenches. This offensive line keeps Claros upright. They're not going to lose very many football games. Look what happened at the second half against BC. Claros was very rarely even rushed, let alone touched, and he was able to pick apart a phenomenally great BC defense. Like, that BC defense is no joke. They have two of the best linebackers in the league. They have an excellent secondary. They have a ferocious front line. Hamilton's offensive line was able to keep them at bay, and they nearly made that comeback. And that's against maybe the best team in this league. You can argue Calgary, you can argue BC, but those are the two teams. That's 1A and 1B as far as I'm concerned. So for Hamilton to do that on the road against a team like Saskatchewan, and I'm not saying they should take them lightly, don't get me wrong, but this is a 1-6 team. This is the team that Hamilton should beat. And if they don't, I think then next week, if we come back after a loss against Saskatchewan, then I think you and I are going to be very, very worried.
Yeah, you know, they lose to Saskatchewan and they're 3-5. And, you know, I don't like seeing the team under 500 anymore. We've seen it for so long. I just want, not the recent years, but you know what I'm talking about. It's just, I want this team to be always above 500 now, because I know they have the talent. I know they have the coaching staff. I know that this team can be a team with a great record. So yeah, they don't have to, but this is a big game for them. It's a big game for Saskatchewan. And if they lose to the Riders, I'm going to be plenty upset.
Well, especially with the week after, you've got a date in Calgary looming with the Stampeders. Hamilton has not won in Calgary in, I believe, 11 or 12 years. So there's a massive losing streak there. You lose this game to Saskatchewan, you're staring down the barrel of a 3-6 start heading into Labor Day. And yeah, they can turn that around and make a run, maybe get to second place and still be a good squad. But it would be a catastrophe, as far as I'm concerned, if this team does not win to get to 4-4. In this game, because I'm looking at that Calgary game and I'm marking it as a loss right now. We'll have to see how both teams look this week, but if they're 3-6 going into Labor Day, they're going to have to do a lot of catching up against the teams like Ottawa and Toronto in the East.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Toronto's in a tough spot right now with Ray out, but I heard he's coming back soon, so that, you know, they could be a pretty good team again once Ray comes back. So, and Ottawa's just is cruising along. You know, Burris is back there. He's been questionable the last couple of weeks, but he's a good quarterback when he can. So there's going to be some tough competition in the East. You never know what Montreal will do. You just don't know. I mean, with Pop being the head coach, they haven't had a lot of success, but they do have a lot of talent. So that Eastern Division is tight right now, and it could get even tighter. So they need everyone they can get before Labor Day, and then really hopefully take off. You know, you're talking about the schedule and all the home games and all the games in Ontario. This is Hamilton's opportunity to go on a really good run here and maybe creep into first place and get some separation from the rest of those East teams. So I'm hoping that we're going to go on a winning streak here and jump up to first place.
Yeah, and that winning streak has to start this week. So defensively, I think it's simple. Don't allow 30-plus points in the first half. We can talk about getting pressure. We can talk about being better in the secondary. We can talk about the linebackers making plays. But it all comes down to every part of that defense needs to execute. They need to be at the top of their game, and they need to not allow Saskatchewan to score at will like they have Edmonton, and like they have Winnipeg, and like they have BC. So simply put, if they don't allow 30-plus points in the first half, they're probably going to win this football game.
Yeah, absolutely. They can't fall behind like that in the first half. It's just unacceptable. And, you know, I don't think they will in this game. I think that, you know, they got Durant back there and he's a veteran quarterback. And I still think they can move the ball and do some good things on the offensive side for Saskatchewan. But, you know, the offensive line is not the best there. So maybe this is an opportunity for the front four to get some pressure, and they're close to leading the league in sacks a couple weeks ago. So hopefully they can get some sacks in there and climb back near the top and just get some, you know, inspiration for the future weeks and, you know, get some confidence back in that D-line.
Now, it's been a while since I've seen a game in an opposing team's stadium. I know at the Ticat games, what they'll do is on the first series of offense, the PA announcer will say, and at quarterback is, and he's going to say Zach Collaros this week, and that place is going to go bonkers. Mm-hmm. But they're on offense, and on offense, it's be quiet. I know Zach Collaros is a guy, and he said this numerous times going into last week's game, that he doesn't like being the center of attention. But I think in this game, with it being his first home game since he got injured, the fans have been waiting for him to come back. I'm hoping that maybe they'll do something to get that giant cheer out of the way pregame. Maybe bring him out last. Maybe introduce him separately. I know it's not the way he would want it done, but I think I would prefer that to having the giant cheer be when the team's lining up for their first play on offense. Yeah. Now, in opposing, like, you go to a lot of Edmonton games, did they announce in a quarterback Mike Riley for the Edmonton Eskimos?
Yeah. I'm not sure if they... Not every game. Not that I recall. Sometimes I'm a little late to the games. Getting popcorn or whatever. Whatever. Not that I've noticed, no.
Okay, because I know they do it at Ticat games, and I know this is going to be... I think there's like a couple hundred tickets left. This thing's going to be sold out. The fans have been waiting for this guy for almost a year to come back. It's going to be loud when they say his name. I just hope that maybe they do something pregame to get that out of us. Because I cheer a little bit, but it's like I don't want to cheer too much because you don't want to interrupt the offense. You want it to be as quiet as possible for them to execute. So I don't know. Maybe we'll see some. That's kind of my only little hope of the game. I guess we'll have to I'll have to report back next week what happened.
Yeah, you have to let me know. Random question here. Are you a fan of the Wave?
The Wave? No. I don't really see the point of it.
No. Get out of here with the Wave. I just don't like it. Every time it comes around, I'm like, well, I don't want to do it.
So, no, I never participate in Wave. Where the hell did that come from?
I don't know. It just popped in my head. I was thinking on offense, and then I was thinking at a couple of Edmonton games, they're doing the Wave on offense, and I was like, I don't want to do that. But anyways. Upward and onward.
Yeah, okay. You ready to do some CFL picks, buddy?
Yeah.
All right, so you can still join our Pick'em group. You can probably join it up until the end of the year. Join it up. Sign up to the Oski Weebies Pick'em group. If you win, come in first place, you'll get a cool Ticats prize pack. So after week 8, we have a new top 3. In third place is Sith Fit with 2,993 points. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that is your better half. Am I correct?
That is correct. We are double dipping for that prize pack.
Well, so. That's fine. You can double dip all you want, but she's in third place and you're in 11th, so she's going to have some home bragging rights there. You really don't want to lose to her.
She's doing pretty good. She's beat me in Pick'em, and she beat me in our fantasy league.
Yeah, she's crushing it in fantasy. Yeah. What's she, like 7-1?
Yeah.
And yes.
And she was actually... She's top 10 in the TSN Fantasy League, which is
really? That's pretty good, too. Holy smokes.
She just has to thank me for getting her into it. You know? That's insane. So, she's doing really well. And hopefully we get that Ticats prize back.
Yeah, so if she wins, you're going to steal it from her, or she's just going to win it and not let you touch it?
Well, we'll have to see. I'll probably steal it from her, but she's not going to wear it, that's for sure.
Okay, so second place, we have Cappy D with 3,194 points. And in first place, on a 7-game winning streak, going 4-0 last week, me. I'm in first place, 3,464 points, and I owe you that first place stop, because if not for you bigging up the Winnipeg Blue Bombers last week, I would have picked the Toronto Argonauts. You convinced me otherwise, flipped my pick live on the show. Bombers won. First 4-0 week of the season. Now I'm in first place, which was where you were at the beginning of the year, and then you kind of just fell off. Just to like, in case anyone wasn't paying attention, you're in 11th with 2,421 points. You got some work to do, pal. You're like over 100 points or over 1,000 points back of me. Come on, what are you doing?
I know. It's been, you know, I had a good week last week. I was 3-1. one. I picked the Tie Cats, which was my downfall. But yeah, how about them Bombers? Looks like someone was right in the offseason. Hey.
Let's not get too ahead of ourselves. We're only in week 9.
I'm always right. Yes.
Okay, so let's get to this week's pick. We got back-to-back doubleheaders this week on Friday and Saturday. Personally, I think this is the perfect CFL schedule. 2 games on Friday night, 2 games Saturday, 1 in the afternoon, 1 at night. We start in Ottawa, where the Montreal Alouettes will head to Ottawa to take on the Red Blacks on Friday night. Mike, who you got in this one?
I picked Ottawa. You know, speaking about how I'm always right, I was pretty high on the Alouettes, but that didn't really pan out for me. But yeah, they just been having a tough time the last couple of weeks, and I can't pick against Ottawa at home, so I'm picking the Red Blacks.
I am going upset here. I am putting the 7-0 streak on the line. I'm taking the Alouettes. I don't know why. I don't have a reason for it necessarily. I just feel like Trevor Harris sounds like he's going to be back next week. Maybe Henry Burst here in those footsteps. I know that Ottawa's coming off a bye week, so they should be rested and ready to play. But Montreal cannot be this bad. And it just feels like one of those games where Montreal might sneak in there. They got a good defense. Kevin Glenn did not look great against Edmonton, but he has these where he'll look bad, then he'll look good, then he'll look bad, then he'll look good. I think that we see a really good week from Kevin Glenn, and he outduels Henry Burris. And I think Montreal squeaks out a hard-fought, low-scoring, tight win in Ottawa. So the second game of our doubleheader might be the first of what we will call the games of the year. This one, first place tilt in the West, the heavyweight battle. Calgary heads to BC to take on the Lions. I think this can be the best game of the week. Mike, yeah, who you got in this one?
I'm going for BC. I think that they should have won the last game against Calgary. If not for a couple of late interceptions by Jonathan Jennings, they totally win that game. So BC's hot. Calgary's playing well. Like you said, it's going to be a great game. can't wait to watch this game. So, but I'm going with the Lions to beat the Stampeders in a close one.
I too am going with the Lions. I look at BC and I saw some flaws in their game last week against Hamilton, where they could have had the chance to just really blow that game open and put the boot to the Ticats, and they didn't. And then I look at Calgary and they had to scratch and claw to beat Saskatchewan. I know they're on the road, but Calgary should be better than that. I haven't been as good as Calgary's been. They're the best team in the league right now. They have the top mark. They just seem like there's a little bit missing. They're good enough where they can beat the teams they're supposed to beat. BC's one of those teams that I think can go toe-to-toe, score-to-score with them. I'd like the Lions at home in this one, but yeah, this is going to be the game of the week for sure.
Hopefully the Lions fans, hopefully there's a big crowd on hand, because the Lions deserve it right now. They're just killing it, and hopefully there's a 25,000 plus on hand for that game.
Oh, I hope so. That should be a raucous atmosphere, I hope. It sounded pretty loud there at the end against the Ticats, so hopefully they can use these wins to get some fans in the stands and to get the Lions football being back on the BC radar.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so Saturday's games kick off in the afternoon. We got a Southern Ontario doubleheader. I don't think this happens very often. You don't normally see both the Argos and Ticats hosting home games on the same day. But so Saturday afternoon, 4 o'clock kickoff here in the East, we have the Edmonton Eskimos traveling to BMO Field to take on the Argos. Mike, who you got in this one?
I got the Eskimos because of Toronto's quarterback. I think that last week he threw 5 interceptions and had a real tough time. You can't throw 5 picks in any league and expect to win. I think his receivers let him down quite a few times. They dropped quite a few balls last game. But because he's starting and, I think Edmonton's defense might be turning it around a bit. So I'm going to pick the Eskimos on the road to beat the Argos.
You said everything I could have possibly said. If Ricky Ray was starting for the Argos, I'd be more inclined to go Toronto's way. But in a matchup of Mike Riley versus Logan Kilgore, you gotta side with the reigning Grey Cup MVP. Eskimos take this one. I think it'll be close. I also don't think this one's gonna be very high scoring, but I got the Esks in this one. Saturday night, last game of the week, second part of the Saturday doubleheader. I think I know where you're going. We got the Rough Riders coming to Hamilton to play Ticats. Mike, who you got?
It's Hamilton, obviously. Claros had his first game back last week. Not the best first half, better second half. I think that he puts together a full game this week, and the Ticats walk all over the Rough Riders.
I'm taking Hamilton. No-brainer. I mean, come on. They're at home. Claros is back. The Riders are 1-6. There is no reason to pick Saskatchewan in this game. I'm taking the Ticats. That's it for our picks. You So it looks like we only disagree on the first game of the week. You got Ottawa, I got Montreal. So that'll be the difference. If Ottawa pulls that off, you make the jump up, and I fall back down, hope maybe to the pack. But we'll see. It'll be interesting how that game plays out. And then the rest of the week doesn't really matter because we're going to be tied for those anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So hoping for a 4-0 performance this week.
Yeah, well, you're not going to get one because Montreal's going to win. So anyway, on to questions. We got a couple this week. There is a third question that we were given, but I decided to hold off on this one until next week because it's about ranking the areas of concern for the Ticats. And it's a great question, but I think me going to the game this week, being able to see them live, will give me a better idea of where they sit through some things. So I'm going to withhold this question for the week. We're going to come back to it next week. Is that okay with you, Mike?
Yeah, I can piggyback on your answers.
Okay. All right, awesome. So the first question this week comes from, I believe we've had questions from him before, Gold Bow Tie for Life on Twitter. And he asks us, looking at the players the Ticats lost in the offseason, what is the one player you would take back if available?
That's a good question. And I'm going to give a bit of a surprising answer. You know, our secondary has needed some help. And I think this veteran could have helped out, even though he wasn't a fan favorite in Hamilton. But I'm going to go with Brandon Stewart. I think he could have added some depth to this secondary and helped out quite a bit.
So I think Eric Harris and Terrell Sinkfield, the two guys we lost to the NFL, are the obvious answers. I think we've seen what the linebacking core, and to an extent the secondary, because Harris was a linebacker, but those type, like the Markieff Knowlton types, play a lot. They do a lot of guarding of receivers and slot backs, and they play a lot in the secondary. And Sinkfield was a 1,000-yard guy last year, but I think less so with him than Harris. Worried about losing him or wanting to bring him back, because the Ticats wide receivers have been great so far this season, and Owens has filled in more than admirably for Sinkfield, although it would be nice to have Sinkfield there too. But my choice is also in the secondary, and my choice is a little off the board. He also plays in BC, but it's not Brandon Stewart. It's Mike Edom. And I know Mike Edom, he was a late addition to this team last year. They traded for him from Montreal. He didn't do a ton here. But the reason I think that he's the guy I'd like to bring back is he is starting at safety for the BC Lions. And the Ticats lost Craig Butler to injury to start the season. They shifted Courtney Steven to safety and then started four other American defensive backs. If they had kept Edom, they could have shifted him to start in place of Craig Butler. And Steven would still be on the wide side corner, and the ratio could be adjusted, you know. So like losing Edom because he's a Canadian and being able to still play two Canadians in the secondary, if they would have kept him, I think could have changed the makeup of this team, and I think the team would have been better for it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he was on the downward spiral, it seemed, in his career. He bounced around to a couple teams, and then he seemed to have found a place in BC, and I hear that he's doing a pretty darn good job. So, yeah, it would have been nice to have him back there to help out with the ratio after Butler went down, for sure.
Yeah, he's missed a couple of games out there, but I think he's been a solid contributor. You don't hear about BC fans complaining about their safety position that they have in the past with guys like Koshi Mwamba and other players whose names are not coming into my head right now. I'm drawing a blank. But yeah, I think Edom would have been a great addition. I think Brandon Stewart, your pick, would have been another veteran guy that could have filled in when this secondary was going through its bumps and bruises. And yeah, so I don't think it's a surprise, though, that we both pick secondary guys.
Yeah, it's the weakness right now, and they're trying to fix it with all those. They've signed a couple guys recently, and they're trying to, you know, shuffle players around and trying to fix this thing. And I'm pretty confident that they'll get the secondary they want soon.
Okay, so this is less of a question. I phrased it in a question, but it comes after our comments last week. Adam on the Three Down Nation comment section gave us the question about who were our picks for MLP and the player awards after six games, and he said that we gave short shrift to Bo Levi Mitchell as an MLP candidate. Do you agree with him? Do you think we didn't give Bo Levi Mitchell enough credit as a potential MLP for the first six games of the season?
Well, let's take a look here. Maybe he's I'm looking at his numbers right now. He's second in the league in passing yards, and he's first in TDs. So yes, maybe we slighted him a bit, but even with those numbers, I'm still not giving him it over Mike Riley. I think that Riley's performed much better than Bo Levi Mitchell, even though the stats don't really show that. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's his slow starts that kind of shine me away from, you know, picking him as MLP candidate. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just stupid and it's deceiving me, because you look at his numbers and they're pretty darn good. So, yeah, he could be up there, but I still wouldn't pick him.
Yeah, his numbers are good, obviously, you just mentioned them. His team's winning, they're the best team in the CFL right now. But when I watch him play, I never get that, like, oh, damn feeling. You know that, like, holy smokes, I can't believe he just did that. Yeah. And when I thought about this question, and I thought about why I don't look at Bo Levi Mitchell in the same way that we look at other players, I came to the conclusion that he reminds me a lot of Ricky Ray. Ricky Ray has been one of the best quarterbacks and one of the best players in this league for over a decade. He's one of the best quarterbacks to ever play in the CFL. And he's never really got much MOP consideration. He's been, I believe, the East nominee a couple of times with the Argos, but it usually comes more from like a there's no one else to give it to type situation where it's like, well, no one else has really knocked the doors off. So yeah, I guess Ray deserves the, and he's never won it. I think he's been nominated twice and he's lost it twice. Like they're both great players who do everything right. They're fantastic. They prepare, they go out and they perform, but they're always overshadowed by like flashier players. So like even the year that we talked about Chad Owens winning MOP and he had great receiving numbers and he had great return numbers and he broke like Pinball Clemens' record for combined yards in the season. But he was doing all that return stuff and it wasn't until he got Ricky Ray as his quarterback that the receiving numbers picked up. And I don't think he gets there without Ray, but Owens the flashier year, so he gets the nomination and the award. Like, and I look at Bo Levi Mitchell the same way. He's not as overshadowed anymore because John Cornish is not with Calgary. So he's not really overshadowed by the players on his own team, but he's overshadowed by your Mike Rileys or Darian Durant or a number of other players out west that just seem to maybe not put together the consistent season he does, but put together more like, holy smokes, can't believe he did that type plays.
Yeah, and Ray, you know, Ray over the years has impressed me with his accuracy, with his just the way he tosses the ball and gets the ball into the, you know, gets to his receivers and all that. But Bo just kind of isn't, he has another level he can go to, I think. And once he gets to that level, I will be impressed. But as of right now, you know, I still think he's a really good quarterback, but I think he can improve still and go to another level. So once he gets there, I'll be really impressed.
All right, Mike. Well, that does it for this week. Listen to the show. Subscribe to it on iTunes. Listen to it. Download it at 3downnation.com. You want to throw your questions in there. We already have one for next week, but we're always looking for more. You can nail us on Twitter. Mike, your Twitter digits, please.
Mike_Ticats.
And you can find me at JoshSmith_82. And you can also post the questions in the comment section of the post that the podcast goes up on 3downNation. So that is episode 52 of Podski Wee Wee. I am Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.